Okay, good evening, everyone, and welcome. We might as well get underway. I'm sure people will drop in as we go. So tonight, Jupitron's disease or Jupitron disease, whichever way you like. You can have the S, you can drop it off, you can have the apostrophe. There's a bit of debate about it. Either way, Jupitron's disease, a little bit of a discussion about it. It's somewhat lighthearted. We're not going to delve too deeply into it, but please ask questions. If you do have a question, put it into the Q&A and we'll get to them either along the way or at the end. So we won't mess around. We'll get straight on with it and talk about Jupitron's disease. So what is it? I might be preaching to the converted, but we'll start right at the beginning. So Jupitron's disease, actually, if we're going to be particular, is the formation of this scar tissue, this fibrotic tissue in the normal fascial planes of the hand, which we'll talk about the anatomy of that in a moment. And it comes from this predisposition, mostly hereditary, that again we'll talk about. But the formation of the scar is the disease. The end result is the contracture. So one of the important points as we go along is that when we do any surgical management, if we get involved in surgical management, we're treating the contracture. We can't actually treat the disease. So Jupitron's disease is the formation of this scar tissue in normal fascial structures of the hand, which results in contracture. So it's called Jupitron's because of the French surgeon, Baron Guillaume Jupitron, who described it. Now, there's controversy about that, which we'll go into, but he ended up with the eponymous naming of this condition. It's about 4 to 6% of Caucasian populations. Again, we'll talk about that from a hereditary point of view. And it's very predominant in older males. It is in the genome, autosomal dominant, but it's highly variable in terms of penetrance and it's highly variable in terms of expression. So although it runs in the family line, it's buried in the genome. If someone's father has it, it doesn't mean they'll have it. If someone's brother has it severely, it doesn't mean they'll have it severely. So sometimes you'll ask someone if they have a family history and their brothers and their father don't have any history at all, but an uncle twice removed will have quite severe disease. So it bounces around. And then if someone does get it, the actual expression is highly variable as well. So the presence of palmar nodules indicating early Jupitron's doesn't mean that you're going to go on and have severe contractures. It's often called this Viking's disease, because of the Anglo-Saxon lineage, and that's where the origin of hereditary is. It's got a very high incidence in Australia because of that English-British migration, and the disease we see in Australia can be quite aggressive. So the diathesis, which we'll talk about soon, is this tendency towards aggressive disease, and that tends to have a stronger family history. So the Baron, and this is Jupitron's statue in Paris, and I've called Dr. Baron and Dr. Google because there is abundant information, not all of it sensible, but Dr. Google comes up with all sorts of things out on the internet. Originally it was the Baron, and now we've got Dr. Google as well, and this is Jupitron himself. And Jupitron published these, or spoke about these first three cases at the Hotel Dieu. But the disease itself was already published by Platter and Klein and Astley Cooper much earlier. But somehow Jupitron ended up with the eponymous name. And since then, there's been an explosion of literature. Jupitron's cases included a case of a wine merchant discussed here whose ring and little fingers, the most common digits, were involved and were treated with multiple open fasciectomies. Jupitron, interestingly, also spoke about attempts at conservative management of Jupitron. So he talked about trying to get a patient to strap their hand to a wooden board to try and prevent the contracture. But he also lamented how terrible people's compliance might be with that sort of regime. Jupitron's statue gets decorated, or historically has been decorated, by the medical students in Paris and can be seen on an annual basis in all sorts of different garb. I've just put one in here. So in Jupitrons, we have this normal fascia. So the normal fascial bands of the hand, so the normal structures are called bands. And when they form this scar tissue and become confluent, they form into cords. So the normal fascia is a band and the diseased fascia is called a cord. And essentially the disease is just thickening of normal anatomical structure. And it's not a disease of the tendon. So often it'll be mistaken as a tendon thickening or a tendon disease, but it's actually lying superficial to the tendon sheath. Here's a nice diagram where we can see these normal fascial structures. And it's a continuation here of palmaris longus into the palmar aponeurosis and these extensions of fascia, which form structural elements in the hand. These fascial bands are functional. They allow us to set grasp, to tension the palm and allow for grip of objects. So the fascia is functional and normal, but when involved in Jupitrons becomes the pathological element forming the cords. Here's a closer picture of a digit showing the multitude of these different ligaments or fascial structures that are in the volar and dorsal aspect of the digit. And any of these structures can be involved with Jupitrons, causing all sorts of patterns of disease, which can be extremely entertaining at surgical dissection as they wrap themselves around the neurovascular bundles. So all of these structures, all of these normal anatomical sheets can be involved in Jupitrons. It's not random. It follows these anatomical pathways, but not always in a linear fashion. It might go from the palmar fascia to a natatory ligament to a digital sheet and move its way up one side. But it always will develop in relation to the normal fascia. So how does a Jupitrons patient present? You've probably all seen a few. It's very common. There is talk that the sign of benediction, such as this, was actually due to these old religious figures having Jupitrons disease and by default became a religious sign. But this is the common presentation. The ring and little finger are the most commonly involved early, and the disease as it progresses into cords into the digit can cause flexion contracture of the digits. Now all of the digits can be involved, but it is predominantly and more commonly on the ulnar side. So Jupitrons has these thick fibrous bands or cords of connective tissue that cause joint contractures. They cause dimpling and pitting in the palm. They can cause knuckle pads or the garrods pads on the dorsal aspect of the digits. And this can also present in the feet, the plantar pads, also known as Lederhosen's disease, or as penile plaques, known as Peyronie's. Here's an example of fairly early palmar nodules causing some pitting and skin tensioning, but not yet any progression into the digit causing contracture. So this is very early, very typical palmar nodular disease of Jupitrons. As it progresses and those nodules become confluent, it can extend up the digit and start to cause the contracture of the joints here. Significant MP joint contracture, but without any PIP contracture. We'll talk about why that's relevant in a moment. But here we might have something like 30 degrees MCP joint contracture already. As you can see here as well, though, the disease is fairly isolated to the little finger and the rest of the hand is virtually spared. Not an uncommon presentation, actually. Here a much more severe presentation. Here we've got multiple digits involved. We have radial side disease in the first web space and this very prominent cord running up the middle finger. Now here we've got some contracture of the MP joint here and most importantly a contracture of the PIP joint. So we may be 30 degrees PIP joint contracture already, which is a much more significant deformity when it comes to restoration of normality and rehabilitation. And here, very severe bilateral multiple digits involved with severe contracture, their little fingers grossly distorted bilaterally, involvement of first web space and index finger. This is very severe Dupuytren's and requires pretty significant intervention. So a little more about the epidemiology. We mentioned the Vikings disease in this Anglo-Saxon origin. And we mentioned diathesis. So what is the diathesis? So if a patient has these factors, it is an indicator or a prognostic indicator that they may be destined for severe disease. So this strong family history, ectopic disease, so having it in the dorsal digits, in the plantar fascia or in the penis can be a diathesis factor. Bilateral disease, also radial side disease. So we said most commonly is ulnar side. Someone presenting with radial side disease is part of the diathesis. Very early onset, a young man, 30 years old with radial side disease and plantar fascia nodules is a strong diathesis example. Associated diabetes and proliferative form of the disease. So very proliferative. It says the isolated little finger, but that can be severe, but not necessary diathesis on its own. Jim Houston was an Australian surgeon who did a lot of work on Dupuytren's disease. And in this quote is talking about the fact that this disease, when severe, is very difficult to battle. So even after an impeccable fasciectomy, taking out all of the disease and getting everything moving, it's ultimately going to be that patient's disease that determines how they go. So it will determine how quickly it comes back, how severe it is, and how much deformity they have later on. So not always is surgical excision going to be curative. If someone has very severe disease, the Dupuytren's will continue and will come back. So when someone has Dupuytren's, we saw a few photos there of different stages of disease. So when do we step in? We go back to this patient with these isolated palmar nodules. Do we see this and go straight in and make incisions and cut the hand open? Well, not necessarily. The disease itself is benign. And on occasion, we see isolated palmar nodules end up being just that. They have a proliferative phase, they become large, they burn themselves out, the myofibroblasts contract, they shrink slightly, and the patient's left with this type of formation. Now, if that's not a functional issue, why do anything about it? So there's no indication if the patient has no functional problems to perform any surgery. There's greater risk of harm than there is, say, a potential benefit. When you might consider operating on an isolated palmar nodule is if this nodule is so large that it's creating functional issues with grip. So a patient might be a manual worker or a tradesperson and they have to grip tools with this hand. If they need to do that and they've got this virtual marble sitting in their palm pressing on their digital nerve whenever they make a fist, that's a real functional issue that may need addressing. So if that's the issue, it's probably very worthwhile to go and excise this. So if it's becoming a functional issue, even if it's isolated palmar disease, it's reasonable to take it out. If there's no problem at all and they're functioning normally, no pain, no issues, full function, it's worth monitoring the disease and seeing whether this starts to progress. It may or it may not. In this situation, it might be very tempting to say, well, straight away we are going to intervene, but it's not always that simple. On the most basic level, however, of course, this patient is outwardly a surgical candidate. They have PIP joint contracture along with a significant isolated palmar cord, and they have this one as well, but we'll just think about middle finger for now. They've got PIP joint contracture, which is significant. They've got some MP joint contracture here and this isolated palmar cord. So this is likely to be a functional problem. They can't put their hand flat on a table. They may have difficulty putting their hand in their pocket. They may poke themselves in the eye washing their face. They might be embarrassed about shaking hands if and when we ever get back to shaking hands again. So there's likely to be some functional problems. There's definitely some pathological distortion, and so surgery may be indicated. Now, having said that, I have quite a few patients that have disease of this nature or worse who might be long into their retirement and tell me that they can still get their golf club or their fishing rod in their hand and make a fist, and they're not interested in me touching them. So although there might be a severe contracture, and it's much like the severe arthritis patients, you have to look at the difference between form and function. So anatomically or on outward appearance, this is a gross deformity and gross impairment, but it's creating no disability for the patient. So someone with lots of comorbidities, someone late in retirement who's very busy fishing and playing golf, they may not want an excision. And again, that's perfectly fine. I will counsel them, however, that if this PIP joint starts to progress further and further, that I may not be able to do much about restoring extension in this joint. As long as they're informed of what they're getting themselves into, that's entirely reasonable. What are the treatments that are out there? And here's where Dr. Google becomes really fun in terms of the imaginarium of things. Now, treatments that are quite legitimate and reasonable and that I offer all the time is just observation, as we said. You've got some palmar nodules, they're fairly minor, they're not getting in the way, they haven't grown in the last 3 months. Let's just watch and see what happens. PNF is percutaneous needle fasciotomy, which is a minor operation procedure where we actually rupture the cord through a needle puncture. So very low impact, relatively low risk, but doesn't resect any of the disease, purely ruptures the cord. If we go back to this fellow, we may perform a percutaneous needle fasciotomy, you know, at this level here, and just rupture that cord to allow some extension. Probably won't affect the PIP joint, but it'll get the finger a little straighter and stop some tension across the palm. So it's a temporizing measure. Collagenase is perhaps the fancy version of the same and does a similar thing. The collagenase allows us to rupture the cord and potentially dissolve a small section of the cord to create a fire break. That rupture allows the finger to come out straighter. It's relatively low risk. It's much lower downtime and less rehab than surgery. So I find the people that like collagenase are time poor people that need to get particularly self-employed. They don't have sick leave, they don't have time off. They just want to get their finger a bit straighter and keep going. So collagenase has its uses. Surgery is the last one that we use often, and that can be minimal access or minor excision, all the way up to full excisions and skin grafting. Now, there's all sorts of other things, massage, attempts at splinting, and I said in terms of splinting, Jupitron already tried that. The problem is compliance. You can splint, but you've got to splint forever, and people just aren't up to doing that. People try ultrasound, they do laser, they try some steroid injection. And the latest fad is to irradiate the palm, which you can make your own decision on that. So there's all sorts of other things out there. And, you know, if you're in a monitoring phase, it's a benign disease. Most of these things do no harm. And if it's going to do absolutely no harm, then it's worth trying. Steroid injection is probably a reasonable one if they're getting some discomfort. And sometimes a steroid injection can be combined with the percutaneous needle fasciotomy for double the effect. So I mentioned collagenase, so the Xiaflex. It had a big spike in interest and activity. It became very popular, and it's probably sort of leveling out now. It looks like curves. We're all very familiar with curves at the moment. So the Xiaflex uses this clostridial collagenase enzyme, which is refined and isolated, and we can inject it directly into the cord, give it 24, 48 hours, a few days, and it will dissolve the Jupitron's cord and allow us to rupture. And it's just done through a needle puncture. There's virtually, there is no external wound unless we get a skin tear. So here's a little case example, a patient we see here, ring finger again, as we mentioned, pretty significant contracture across the MP joint here, which is sort of moving like this. Not a lot of PIP contracture. So a good candidate for Xiaflex with a nice thick cord. So the Xiaflex is injected and it's just done under a bit of local anesthetic in the office. And it's allowed to cook for a couple of days and they come back looking like this. It's quite, there's quite a reaction to clostridial enzymes. As you can imagine, the body doesn't like it. They get quite a lot of bruising in the area. They can even get a lymphadenopathy and discomfort all the way up to the axilla as the body reacts to this insult. But this is a typical appearance as a patient comes back. A little bit more local anesthetic in the area, and we perform an extension procedure, and there's usually a very satisfying little snap. Patient here, you can see immediately post-rupture, is now out nice and straight. So they've gone from this position here to nice and extended. And then we've got to get them moving because there's a bit of swelling. We want to make sure we move the hand early, otherwise they'll get stiff. Additionally, place them into a splint to wear at night for a month or two to make sure that the scar tissue doesn't form when they're sleeping and have the hand in a fist. So it's a nice, neat little trick to inject this enzyme, rupture the cord. The patient's returned to function very quickly. There's no wounds to manage. The downside is we're not resecting any disease, so it does come back. And the other big problem with it at the moment, particularly in Australia, I'm not sure about those in other countries who are here tonight, but particularly in Australia, it's very expensive. So even for people with private health insurance, it's expensive. And so it comes down to those people that really can't afford to take any time off work. It's more expensive for them to take time off than it is to pay for the injection. That's the patient group I find really like collagenase. Complications of collagenase. Well, as we mentioned, the pain and the bruising and the swelling and lymphadenopathy. It's not uncommon to get a skin tear as we perform the extension procedure to tear the skin in the palm. That's not uncommon, and we'll counsel everybody that may happen. They heal very quickly. Very, very low incidence of anything else serious. There's been no incidence of severe allergic reaction or anaphylaxis, although we are always prepared for that. And very, very low incidence of tendon injury. Anyone that administers this has to be a hand surgeon and qualified so that the anatomy is well known. And the tendon is avoided. You wouldn't want to inject it in a tendon. So tendon injury is low. It did happen in the trial, so there are some guidelines around how to avoid that. Nerve injury problem is low. And the other thing would be stiffness and loss of function. So that therapy is very important. And here's that patient recovered with nice extension following the rupture and the swelling's come down. Surgery for Jupitrons has many different approaches, which we'll see in a moment, but it can be extremely invasive. So despite all of these different incisions, which we'll look at in a minute, here we go, all of these different types of incisions described here for the purposes of publishing something in a journal, despite all of those different incisions, the principle is that an incision is made, the skin is lifted off the disease. The disease is resected, preserving the nerves, and the surgery is essentially a dissection of the digital nerves, removing anything that's not digital nerve. Resection of the disease, extension of the digit, and then closure of the wounds. So it is very invasive to skeletonize the neurovascular bundles to operate all the way down to the tendon sheath. But sometimes it's the only option, and sometimes it absolutely is the best option. When do we operate? Well, I mentioned a second ago a couple of the criteria. That long-standing contracture of the MCP joint, so we say 30 degrees or more, but that's fairly arbitrary whenever it starts to get in the way or they can't put their hand flat. The thing about the MCP joint is that the MCP joint, when it contracts, doesn't really create an unsalvageable situation. So even if it gets quite deep into contracture, it's easily correctable. The PIP joint is different. If the PIP starts to contract, the contracture can be fixed. And even if we release the disease, the joint itself becomes stiff, the collateral ligaments are tight, and it's difficult to resolve. So any PIP contracture can indicate surgery. If there's functional disability, we mentioned that. So subjective symptoms like the big marble in the palm, something getting in the way. But that's only if the patient understands what you have to do. So you have to say, well, I can take it out, but I've got to dissect the nerves. There's a risk to the nerves. There's recovery time, scar tissue, etc. And if there is bilateral cases, we'll have to be very judicious about how we approach that. Houston, who we mentioned before, he would only want to do two fingers at a time on one hand. So that's an even stricter little set of rules, but that's all about the burden of rehabilitation. So if we're doing bilateral, we'll do the worst or the dominant or the one bugging the patient the most first, get them up and going, get them functional and happy, then go to the other side. So we can do a limited fasciectomy. So we, as I said, a smaller incision, just take some of the disease out, or we can do a radical fasciectomy. We open the whole digit up, take everything out down to the tendon sheath, skeletonize the neurovascular bundles, and then close up. So although there's no clear evidence that this universally creates a longer disease-free interval, in the patients who do have good clearance, they can go for many, many, many years without disease. Fasciotomy is just essentially rupturing the cord, like our collagenase. We mentioned we can do that needle fasciotomy from time to time. Here's that multitude or imaginarium of incisions. Most surgeons will have their favorite, and most of the favorites are not here. The favorite is probably this longitudinal incision or a Brunner's type incision. They would be the two favorites in Australia, a longitudinal closed with Z-plasties, little zigzags across the joint, or a Brunner's where the zigzags can be relaxed. The Z-plasty is the one I use. It's longitudinal. It allows me to place and tension Z-plasties at the joint, and they end up with a scar that looks like this, like a lightning bolt. And no matter how many times you tell them what it's going to look like, they're always shocked by this lightning bolt scar. This is an extremely radical fasciectomy. Proud to say it's not mine, but an example of how if you're operating on four different digits and performing this extension, you can create large defects that require grafting. The joint management can be a problem, that PIP joint. We can get a little aggressive with it. If there's a severe contracture, 30 or 40 degrees, sometimes it's false economy to really go releasing all of the joint, try and get it out straight. So it's a word of caution to try and get full extension at the expense of the joint rehabilitation. So joints need to be carefully managed with a modest and realistic expectation about what we're going to achieve. So someone with a 50 degree contracture, we may tell them that they might want to look at achieving 20 degree contracture rather than zero, which would be unrealistic. If we push too hard, the finger ends up getting stiff. There's a lot of scar. It's difficult. But PIP joint management and Jupitrons is a point of contention and a subject of debate at lots and lots of hand conferences. Here's Bill Nighy, who's a British actor. He has very severe Jupitrons disease, and now I've mentioned it, you'll see it in all his movies, and he's elected to have nothing done. But he's got severe contracture of his ulnar two digits, it's just one of those people that it doesn't bother him, so he carries on. Just as a little aside, though, this can become a problem if the contracture is so severe that hygiene in underneath those digits is impossible and their skin becomes macerated and ulcerated. That can be a real issue. Maybe Bill's going to need to do something one day. Complications of surgery. Well, all the usual: infection, bleeding, nerve injury is a big one. If the nerve is running through this scar, it can be injured. And I can admit to having cut a few nerves in my time. Every hand surgeon will have. So nerve injury is one of them. Stiffness and loss of function. So rehab's very important. If the patients don't participate, it can be a big problem. We talked about recurrence. And this is a slide I came across as I was researching over the last week for this talk, and it's from my training days, and I'd totally forgotten about it. But I think it summarizes it quite well. And I might use it with my patients from now on. You want to tell them about scars, their temporary loss of function. So they're in a splint for a week, and then they're going to have trouble getting things moving. The sutures come out at 2 weeks. You want to talk to them about that. You want to tell them that recurrence is possible. There's one saying that the recurrence for Jubitrons is 100% if you live long enough. Now, there is also a lot of debate about what is recurrence. So does recurrence mean a nodule in the palm? Does recurrence mean a cord in the digit? Does recurrence mean return of contracture in the digit? So it's probably 100% if you're talking about any disease anywhere in that hand. Absolutely, it will turn up somewhere. But recurrence in the digit probably drops off and is lower. And as Houston said, the diathesis is the main factor behind recurrence. We want to talk to the patient about the aim. Are we going to straighten the fingers completely? Are we aiming for residual contracture? Where are we going to stop our dissection? What disease are we going to leave behind? I want to tell them about the fact that we don't know much about why it's caused, and it's genetic. We want to tell them absolutely that this is not sinister, that it's not malignant. It's an incredible number of people that you say, this is not malignant, and they're completely relieved. They've got a lump in their palm that's growing. They're very worried. So absolutely reassure them this is not malignant. Once you're convinced that it's not, of course. I want to tell them about their healing time. I want to talk to them about those complications. And as I mentioned up there in aim of surgery, that we may have incomplete release of the contracture. This is a nice little summary of a Jubitrons discussion, straight up. Here's those problems again, complications, delayed wound healing. Almost universally, there'll be a bit of wound breakdown. The skin flaps are very thin. You can get a bit of breakdown in a corner here and there. That's fairly ubiquitous. I tell the patients it's fine. I counsel them in the post-op. I'll see them every week for the first few weeks just to counsel them through the appearance of the wound. It's okay, that bit of breakdown, it's not a problem, there's no infection, and to push them through that rehab. Joint stiffness can be a problem. Numbness, so even though the nerves may not be cut, they will be handled, and so you can get a neuropraxia transiently. So the finger might be numb for a while. As long as I know at the end that the nerve was intact, I can reassure them it's going to come back. Recurrence, pain, and RSD, or the old CRPS, so we call it sometimes Jubitrons flare. It can occur. It's usually associated with very high levels of immediate postoperative pain and a failure to engage in early therapy. So if you have a patient postoperatively, day one rings up, they're in their plaster and they say, you know, the pain's unbearable, I can't stand it. I would absolutely not fob them off with take some more painkillers. I would get that patient in. It's unusual to have that much discomfort. And I would get them into the office. I'd take their plasters off. I would check the wounds. I would reassure them it's all okay. And sometimes it's enough just to take the plaster off and let them look at the wound, and it can dial back their anxiety and their discomfort. So more often than not, these terrible flares are due to uncontrolled perioperative pain or pain perception, fear, anxiety, or homuncular overload. And the other thing is that if they really don't participate or they don't turn up to their therapy, they can get very stiff. So you want to make sure they're comfortable postoperatively and then commence their rehab within 5 to 7 days. Just a couple of examples here of very severe resections with skin grafting in the palm, these dermofasciectomies and skin graft. And another one here, very severe disease treated with this huge dermofasciectomy and graft and resection. And this one, the PIP contracture at that little finger being so severe that it required amputation. Rehabilitation, as I said, extremely important. So in the immediate period, again, this is controversial. I like plaster to rest the hand and allow some of the swelling to come out and allow some of the wounds to settle. Now, I leave that on for 3 to 5 days and then get them moving. Some surgeons, day one, their dressing's off and away they go. For me, that's a bit early. I just like them to have a little rest, let the wounds settle, and then get them into their therapy when there's no ooze anymore, the wounds are nice and dry, and the swelling's come out of it a bit. So for me, 3 to 5 days, immobilization in a posi splint with elevation and some analgesia, let those swelling settle down, and then we get underway. Once they start their therapy, early mobilization and this night splinting, so night extension splint, keep them in that extended position to maintain it. If you don't put that on, everyone, nobody sleeps with their hand out straight. So they'll be sleeping with their hands clenched or their fingers flexed, and the scar tissue will form in that position and you've got a worse contracture than before. So night extension splint, early mobilization. And then if there's further problems, little contractures here and there, splints to correct those. And then we follow them up 3 to 6 months to make sure that the tissue equilibrium is achieved, that everything's gone quiet, the scars are soft and they're happy. Here's another little Jupitron costume here in Paris. Be nice if I could get back there again one day. And that's all I had for this evening. So that's a little discussion about Jupitrons, what it is, what causes it, patient presentations, the options for treatment, when we might intervene, as well as some of those complications with intervention. So thank you very much for coming along, and have a good night. And we'll see you next time at the next hand surgery webcast. See you. Bye-bye.